Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the program, we have stories from Anne Ball, Phil Dierking, and Alice Bryant. We close the show with our program, American Stories. This week, we bring you a tall tale about the legendary lumberjack Paul Bunyan. But now we go to Anne Ball.
The United States-based group Freedom House says democracy dropped in more than half of the countries it studied last year. Freedom House rated the health of democracy in 29 countries in Central and Eastern Europe, as well as in Central Asia. All 29 were once under Communist Party rule. The findings are part of a new report called Nations in Transit 2017. This is the second largest drop in democracy ratings in the 22 years Freedom House has produced the report. The group blames the drop on the rise of populism. It noted that leaders in some countries are openly attacking democracy. The report says Hungary, led by Prime Minister Viktor Orban, now has the lowest rating of any country in Central Europe. Nate Schenken works for Freedom House in New York. He spoke to VOA on Skype.
When we talk about populism in Central Europe, Orban is the first name. He has created a kind of model for member states, even of the European Union, to reject democracy.
There were pro-democracy protests in Hungary last Sunday. 2 days later, Hungary's government press office reacted to the Freedom House report. It said, "Freedom of the press fully prevails in Hungary. Every political opinion can find room and be published in the Hungarian press." And it said, "Hungarian citizens can exercise their democratic rights in free elections." The report also criticized the leader of Poland's ruling Law and Justice Party, Jarosław Kaczyński. It said that populist leaders in both Poland and Hungary had attacked constitutional courts and sought to weaken the system of checks and balances. The Freedom House said the spectacular breakdown of democracy in these countries should serve as a warning about the fragility of the institutions that are necessary for liberal democracy. Russia had one of the report's lowest ratings. Yet Freedom House says a highly developed civil society continues to exist there, along with some independent media. But a former Russian central bank official disagrees. Sergei Alexashenko now works at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. He spoke to VOA on Skype.
You may say that there is some freedom on the internet, but if you look that 80% of Russian population, they receive news from television, and there is no any television news station that is not controlled by the government, that, okay, you may argue that there is some freedom. Of course, there is, but it's not a freedom. It's not a freedom of information. And in my personal view, it's a serious misjudgment of what's going on in Russia.
In the Balkans, the democracy scores for four countries dropped over the past year. Two improved, Montenegro and Croatia. Sergei Aleksashenko said Balkan countries should not be compared to Western Europe. He noted they have had to create systems, governmental and state cultures since the end of communist rule. He said that is not an easy process. Freedom House once again described Kyrgyzstan as a consolidated authoritarian regime. The country had been removed from the classification after competitive parliamentary elections in 2011. The report said corruption in Eurasia dropped in 5 of the 12 countries, but reached new lows in Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan. Freedom House pointed to progress in Ukraine, Romania, and Kosovo. It said the Romanian government dealt with problems in the voting process during its 2015 elections. And it said both Ukraine and Kosovo enacted minor structural reforms. But the group said the two countries face obstacles that could stop the progress. I'm Ann Ball.
The number of tourists visiting Cambodia's genocide sites has more than tripled over the last 10 years. They are visiting memorials for the nearly 2 million people killed under Pol Pot and his Khmer Rouge. But the sharp increase in tourism is creating problems. Visitors are disturbing some sites and making preserving the memories difficult. Chung Ek is the best known of the genocide sites. It is also known as the Killing Fields. The site is located 17 kilometers south of Cambodia's capital city, Phnom Penh.
Each day, tourists arrive by tuk-tuk, or a three-wheeled taxi, motorbike, and air-conditioned buses. Chur Sok Ti is director at Chung Ek. He said that in the 11 years he has been working there, the number of visitors has increased from 100 to 800 a day. He believes media promotions, road improvements, and additions such as public toilets are helping bring more people to the site. The place is not a happy one. Human skulls are stacked neatly in a stupa, a round-shaped monument. They are surrounded by mass graves. Here, thousands of people were beat to death and buried. They were all victims of the 1975 to 1979 mass killings by Pol Pot's men. Cobb Kalyani works for a private tour agency that brings people to the killing fields. She said tourists want to learn if the history is real, and they want to witness it. There are hundreds of sites across Cambodia, like Chiang Ek. The difference is that here, and at the S21 extermination camp in Phnom Penh, people pay to enter. The cost helps bring income for people such as booksellers, street vendors, tuk-tuk drivers, tour companies, and even beggars.
Unfortunately, too many tourists have left their mark. Some tourists write graffiti on prison walls at S21 in Phnom Penh. This is the site of the Tuol Sleng Genocide Museum, where Pol Pot's victims were processed before being sent to the killing fields. At S21, visitors can see buildings, prison cells, and graphic displays of paintings and photographs, along with tools of torture. At Chiang Ek, some people innocently tie ribbons and notes to the mass graves, but others collect pieces of bones, smoke cigarettes, or eat on the steps of the bone-filled stupa. Many ignore rules restricting cameras and asking for silence. Yuk Chung is the executive director of the Documentation Center of Cambodia, or DCCAM. He said one reason people behave inappropriately at the sites is because they do not know the rules. But he added that photos of Khmer Rouge leaders often had to be replaced because visitors would write graffiti on them. People get so upset when they see the photographs of the Khmer Rouge leaders, so they write on it. I think that it can be bad, it can be good, he said. You cannot stop people from being or feeling upset.
He added that neither Chiang Ek nor S21 were designed to be businesses run for profit. We should preserve for our children, not for the tourists. But tourists are welcome if they want to visit, if they want to see it, if they want to understand it, they're welcome. That's the whole purpose of the preservation of the site, he said. The genocide sites are not only important for students and visitors, however. The Khmer Rouge Tribunal is using the bones and human remains as evidence. The tribunal has spent the last decade prosecuting Pol Pot's surviving lieutenants. It has secured 3 convictions so far for crimes against humanity. Currently, 2 former leaders, Nguyen Chia and Khieu Samphan, are on trial for genocide. More cases involving lower-ranking members are still waiting. One remaining question is what to do with the human remains after the tribunal is finished. Many people believe the bones should be cremated according to Buddhist tradition. But others say the sites should be kept as they are.
It's our memory. It should be preserved the way it is, historically, and with respect to our culture, rather than try to create something to attract tourists that's leading to commercializing the memory, which is something that you do not want to do, Yuk Chung of DC CAM said. Yuk Chung said the prison originally had a large wall map of Cambodia made of human skulls. He said it was far more intense than the current experience. And that itself also creates a feeling. It forces people to show some respect because it is so original, he said. Some have suggested adding a guestbook in each room at the S21 prison, where people can think and write about their experiences. But any change would be limited and any major work delayed until after the Khmer Rouge Tribunal has finished its work. I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Alice Bryant.
It's time for an American story. This week, we have a traditional story called A Tall Tale. A tall tale is a story about a person who is larger than life. The descriptions in the story are exaggerated, much greater than in real life. This makes the story funny. Long ago, people who settled in undeveloped areas of America first told tall tales. After a hard day's work, people gathered to tell each other funny stories. Each group of workers had its own tall tale hero. Paul Bunyan was a hero of North American lumberjacks, the workers who cut down trees. He was known for his strength, speed, and skill. Tradition says Paul Bunyan cleared forests from the northeastern U.S. to the Pacific Ocean. Some people say Paul Bunyan was the creation of storytellers from the Middle Western Great Lakes area. Others say the stories about him came from French Canada. Here is Shep O'Neill with our story about Paul Bunyan.
Many years ago, Paul Bunyan was born in the northeastern American state of Maine. His mother and father were shocked when they first saw the boy. Paul was so large at birth that five large birds had to carry him to his parents. When the boy was only a few weeks old, he weighed more than 45 kilograms. As a child, Paul was always hungry. His parents needed 10 cows to supply milk for his meals. Before long, he ate 50 eggs and 10 containers of potatoes every day. Young Paul grew so big that his parents did not know what to do with him. Once, Paul rolled over so much in his sleep that he caused an earthquake. This angered people in the town where his parents lived, so the government told his mother and father they would have to move him somewhere else. Paul's father built a wooden cradle, a traditional bed for a baby. His parents put the cradle in waters along the coast of Maine. However, every time Paul rolled over, huge waves covered all the coastal towns. So his parents brought their son back on land. They took him into the woods. This is where he grew up. As a boy, Paul helped his father cut down trees. Paul had the strength of many men. He also was extremely fast. He could turn off a light and then jump into his bed before the room got dark. Maine is very cold for much of the year. One day, it started to snow. The snow covered Paul's home and a nearby forest. However, this snow was very unusual. It was blue. The blue snow kept falling until the forest was covered. Paul put on his snowshoes and went out to see the unusual sight. As he walked, Paul discovered an animal stuck in the snow. It was a baby ox. Paul decided to take the ox home with him. He put the animal near the fireplace. After the ox got warmer, his hair remained blue. Paul decided to keep the blue ox and named him Babe. Babe grew very quickly. One night, Paul left him in a small building with the other animals. The next morning, the barn was gone, and so was Babe. Paul searched everywhere for the animal. He found Babe calmly eating grass in a valley, with the barn still on top of his back. Babe followed Paul and grew larger every day. Every time Paul looked, Babe seemed to grow taller. In those days, much of North America was filled with thick green forests. Paul Bunyan could clear large wooded areas with a single stroke of his large, sharp axe. Paul taught Babe to help with his work. Babe was very useful. For example, Paul had trouble removing trees along a road that was not straight. He decided to tie one end of the road to what remained of a tree in the ground. Paul tied the other end to Babe. Babe dug his feet in the ground and pulled with all his strength until the road became straight. In time, Paul and Babe the Blue Ox left Maine and moved west to look for work in other forests. Along the way, Paul dug out the Great Lakes to provide drinking water for Babe. They settled in a camp near the Onion River in the state of Minnesota. Paul's camp was the largest in the country. The camp was so large that a man had to have 1 week's supply of food when walking from one side of the camp to the other. Paul decided to get other lumberjacks to help with the work. His work crew became known as the Seven Axe Men. Each man was more than 2 meters tall and weighed more than 160 kilograms. All of the axe men were named Elmer. That way, they all came running whenever Paul called them. The man who cooked for the group was named Sourdough Sam. He made everything, except coffee, from sourdough, a substance used in making sourdough bread. Every Sunday, Paul and his crew ate hotcakes. Each hotcake was so large that it took 5 men to eat one. Paul usually had 10 or more hotcakes, depending on how hungry he was. The table where the men ate was so long that a server usually drove to one end of the table and stayed the night. The server drove back in the morning with a fresh load of food. Paul needed someone to help with the camp's finances. He gave the job to a man named Johnny Inkslinger. Johnny kept records of everything, including wages and the cost of feeding Babe. He sometimes used 9 containers of writing fluid a day to keep such detailed records. The camp also was home to Sport, the reversible dog. One of the workers accidentally cut Sport in two. The man hurried to put the dog back together, but made a mistake. He bent the animal's back the wrong way. However, that was not a problem for Sport. He learned to run on his front legs until he was tired. Then he turned the other way and ran on his back legs. Big mosquitoes were a problem at the camp. The men attacked the insects with their axes and long sticks. Before long, the men put barriers around their living space. Then, Paul ordered them to get big bees to destroy the mosquitoes. But the bees married the mosquitoes, and the problem got worse. They began to produce young insects. One day, the insects' love of sweets caused them to attack a ship that was bringing sugar to the camp. At last, the mosquitoes and bees were defeated. They ate so much sugar, they could not move. Paul always gave Babe the Blue Ox a 35-kilogram piece of sugar when he was good, but sometimes Babe liked to play tricks. At night, Babe would make noises and hit the ground with his feet. The men at the camp would run out of the buildings where they slept, thinking it was an earthquake. When winter came, Babe had trouble finding enough food to eat. Snow covered everything. Ole, the blacksmith, solved the problem. He made huge green sunglasses for Babe. When Babe wore the sunglasses, he thought the snow was grass. Before long, Babe was strong and healthy again. One year, Paul's camp was especially cold. It was so cold that the men let their facial hair grow very long. When the men spoke, their words froze in the air. Everything they said remained frozen all winter long and did not melt until spring. Paul Bunyan and Babe left their mark on many areas. Some people say they were responsible for creating Puget Sound in the western state of Washington. Others say Paul Bunyan and Babe cleared the trees from the states of North Dakota and South Dakota. They prepared this area for farming. Babe the Blue Ox died in South Dakota. One story says he ate too many hotcakes. Paul buried his old friend there. Today, the burial place is known as the Black Hills. Whatever happened to Paul Bunyan? There are lots of stories. Some people say he was last seen in Alaska, or even the Arctic Circle. Another tradition says he still returns to Minnesota every summer. It says Paul moves in and out of the woods, so few people ever know that he is there.
That's all the time we have for today. But come back tomorrow for another Learning English program on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for joining us.